Okay, so Elaine gave me some basic guidance about what's usually done in the shiur. She said there could be an outline, could not be an outline as we choose, but basically we want to see the five prakim and see what more about what you learned this week. So, in line with what I think is the benefit of 929, I want to, rather than pick out, a Dvar Torah here or a Dvar Torah here, look at the structure, how these prakim fit into a greater context, and I guess we'll see as we go along how successful or unsuccessful I am in that regard. But if it's something that you want to ask about or talk about that I didn't, bring, that's fine with me as well. We start out with Vayikra Perek Chaf Vav, which in the stone here is on page 707, right at the end of Parshas Behar. And right off the bat, you hit something that people get very confused by, naturally, which is Parsha breaks. Which is to say, every time we start a brand new Parsha, so the feeling is this is brand new, and whatever was right before that is a week ago. And, of course, therefore there should be no connection. And it's not so, obviously true. And here, your perek started two psukim before the end of Parshas Behar. And then you go right into Bechukosai, and therefore you have a chance to defeat that idea of discontinuity between Parshios and see that there should be some kind of continuity. So in other words, the last two psukim of Behar, which speak about not making idols, and not setting up a stone floor on which to bow and to guard Shabbos and Mikdash, that should connect to the beginning of Parshas Bechukosai. Now, I'm taking something as a given here, which I assume since you all do the 929 program, you already know, which is that chapter breaks are not ours. The chapter breaks were a gift to us from the church. So, the answer really could be that no, there's no link from the end of Behar to the beginning of the Chukosai. Maybe, in fact, the fact that the chapter started here doesn't mean that it connects. However, I believe it does. So what I want to do first is to ask the question at the end of Behar, these two psukim here about idolatry, about guarding Shabbos and Mikdash, how do they fit into a greater context? Thank the office for copying the sheets. So that's where I want to start off. But in order to do that, in order to understand the flow of things, we need to go back before Perek Chaf Vav, really, and go back to Perek Chaf Hei. So what was the theme in Perek Chaf Hei? What was the theme of the previous chapter? At least the end of the previous chapter, because the chapter itself is very large. There's a lot going on. But the end of the previous chapter was what? Right. It was, well, Eved Ivri, right? A Jew who becomes an Eved, but an Eved to whom?
Presumably to another Jew.
Is it? Take a look.
Well, no, that's a Jew's Jewish slave. No, it's a Jew who becomes a slave to someone who is not a Jew and then has an obligation to redeem.
Right. If you look at Pasuk Mem Zayin, right? It's the Chizasig Yad Ger B'Sarshav Imach. If there's some stranger, right, somebody who comes to reside among you, and your brother becomes impoverished, indebted to him, and is sold to him, right? So it's a Jew who is a slave to a non-Jew. And what it talks about is the imperative of trying to get him out of being an Eved, right? And if you don't succeed, then how does he indeed end his period of slavery? And that leads into the beginning of Perek Chaf Vav. At the end of Chaf Hei, Hashem says, hey, you're supposed to be avadim to me, not to others. Don't make idols for yourself. Do not set up a stone floor on which to bow. Guard my Shabbos. Guard my Mikdash. And then you get the beginning of Parshas Bechukosai, which says, if you follow my laws, everything is going to be wonderful. Right? You will be able to defeat your enemies, and I will make you many, and your produce will be plentiful. And then, of course, if you don't listen, and, the nation drops off a cliff. But the question now is, now that we have a sense just in terms of the psukim, of the flow, right? So it goes from Jew being slave to non-Jew, to not worshipping idols, guard Shabbos and Mikdash. If you do my mitzvahs, things will be wonderful. Okay, so where is your link? How does that flow in any sense? So a couple of notes. First of all, I keep saying that the last sentence in Behar, Perichavav Pasuk Bet on page 707, I keep saying that that's about Shabbos and Mikdash, the temple, because that's what the words seem to say. So, you know, that's my excuse. And our scroll says it, so, you know, all the more so. But you should know, there is a Targum, the Targum Yerushalmi, which suggests that Shabbos here is actually Shemitah, and Mikdash here is actually Yovel, which is a fascinating idea, the Jubilee year, which you read about in the beginning of Parshas Behar. So that's just worth knowing, even though it's not, it's certainly not the standard approach. Generally, we assume it has something to do with Shabbos and the Beis HaMikdash. But what is the link? So commentators tend to assume that what's going on here is an outgrowth of Perek Chav Hei of chapter 25 about being an Eved. Take a look on the sheet, please. Source number one. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, right, as I noted for you on the sheet, writing in 12th century France. So if you think about that, that's a century after Rashi. That's who we're, you know, we're going back quite a ways in terms of what we think of as the standard Parshanim. Not quite as popular as Rashi is, but definitely with great merit. What it's trying to tell you is how to be an Eved. How should a Jew function as an Eved? And what he's saying is, don't sell yourself as an Eved to a non-Jew who's going to tell you to perform Malach on Shabbos. So the way to read these sentences is, guard my Shabbos, don't put yourself in a position where your master is going to force you to violate it. And similarly, Mikdashi Tiro, you should revere my Mikdash. He says it doesn't refer to the Beis HaMikdash, it refers to Kedusha, meaning to the sanctity of Hashem. Which is to say, don't sell yourself to a non-Jew, such that you will desecrate the name of heaven, because he's going to do whatever stuff he does, whatever idolatry he does, and he's going to drag you into it, because you're his slave. Right? If you're familiar with the story of Naaman, the Arami general, that will be an example of it, although he wasn't Jewish. But the idea here is, as explained by Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, is this is a message about not putting yourself in a position to be a slave to non-Jews. It's one last warning in this section, and even though it's stuck into chapter 26, it really is an outgrowth of chapter 25, and it really is about how one would be an Eved. The Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, which I brought you in source number 2, offers a similar theme. He says, even if you are sold, you still have to be careful about that which makes us holy. You have to be careful about Shabbos. You have to be careful about idolatry, about Avodah Zarah. You're going to be sold to them, or you're going to be exiled among them. Alternatively, it isn't just about being a slave. It's also about being in Gullus, being in exile. You have to guard these things. Is that clear? Yeah.
Yeah, and if this is off topic, just say later.
Okay.
But altogether, the whole thing is just so strange to me that so soon after being brought out of slavery, we're being told how to be good slaves.
Well, we're being warned against being slaves, effectively. We're being warned against it. It's not so much being told how to be good slaves as it's a warning of...
Don't let this happen again.
Don't let this happen again, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's the way I would see it. And for that matter, that's actually a good segue, because we didn't answer the question of how this connects forward in the Parsha.
Right.
We only answered how it connects back.
Well, it connects to the anti-Bracha, you know, skipping over the Bracha.
Right.
Chapter of 20, the first part of 27, it connects to.
Right.
Because it says that then the land will have the Shemitah years that you missed.
Right. So I would tell you, even before you get to that, although that's true, take a look at chapter 26, specifically sentence 13. At the end of the section of Bracha, about what you will receive in the event that you do right, the last sentence in that section says, I took you out of Egypt, exactly like you just said. I took you out of Egypt, mihios lahem avadim, from being slaves to them. Here's the way to avoid getting back into that. They fulfill this, and you won't be slaves to them. So not only when you are a slave, guard these things, but you don't want to be put in a position of being a slave lest you have a problem with these things. So that's your flow in the beginning of this five-parak section. It's, you don't want to be a slave to them. Make sure that you don't put yourself in a position to be a slave to them. And instead, follow my commandments, and that way you will avoid this. That's the opening section. But there's something else going on here, which I find fascinating. It's something I've been working on in a couple of different shiurim of late, and finding connections for it. And that is sort of a meta question, an overall question within Tanakh. Tanakh tells the story of our national journey towards something. In other words, it's not just history, and it's not only a book of mitzvahs, do this, don't do that. It's also trying to tell the story of how the Jews will become something. There's a utopia. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. There's something that we're supposed to be achieving, which leads to the question of, what is it we're supposed to be achieving? What exactly does the pot of gold look like? What is our national ambition? When do you know we've succeeded? You know, what is that supposed to look like? So the utopia in Tanakh, in its fullest form, is seen in the second version of what you read. Meaning, there are two sections in Chumash which present for us a tohachah, what's called a tohachah, this lesson in what happens if you fail to keep the bris, keep the covenant. But in both places, it begins with, and here's what will happen if you do keep a covenant. So one is what you read in chapter 26, in Parshas Bechukosai. The other, more elaborate section, is in Parshas Kisavo, in Sefer Devarim. If you could flip to that, please. To chapter 28 in Devarim. It is page 1000 and, well, the part I want is 1075, the beginning of chapter 28. The opening 14 psukim of that chapter, the opening 14 sentences, speak of what you will get if you do what you're supposed to do. What will life look like? This is Tanakh's utopia. This is what success is supposed to look like. So take a look at the description, just going through it quickly. Okay, it's page 1075. It's Devarim Perek Chaf Chet, for those who are using a stone Tanakh. Stone Chumash, I should say. Right? If you will listen to the voice of Hashem, your God, to guard the mitzvah that I'm commanding you today, God will make you superior. He will put you in a position of power over and above all the nations of the land. Right? Those who stick to the covenant will be above. That is not to say, as the Rambam took pains to note, that our goal is that we want to lord it over everybody else. The goal is that others should join us. But those who adhere to the covenant of Hashem will occupy a prime position. And all of these blessings will literally catch up to you. They will overtake you. I like that. The Art Scroll English is good on this. What are these blessings? You'll be blessed in the city, you'll be blessed in the field, your children, your land, your animals, the produce, when you enter, when you exit. Hashem will strike down all of your enemies before you. Those who attack you will be harmed. They will be made to flee. Hashem will send blessing in your granary wherever you go. He will make you a holy nation. When you guard his mitzvot and walk in his ways, and everybody will see the name of Hashem call upon you, they will be in awe of you. And then again, there will be great plenty for you. You will lend money to everybody else. You will not need to borrow money from them. Hashem will make you the leader. You will not be the tail. You will only be above. You will not be below. When you listen to the mitzvot, and you do not stray from them. Right? That's what you see here in the opening 14 psukim. This is success. This is what success looks like in Tanakh. What are the themes of this success? How is success displayed here? What are you seeing? If you can digest it.
Very,
it's very alert.
That's what I'm right.
There's a lot of prosperity, right? Your produce, your animals, you do very well. Prosperity is definitely a part of this. What else is there?
And children. I mean, when I say bounty, I'm including the pre-beat napa.
Good.
And I think that's in there twice, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Along with the fruit of your animals. They are right there in the same sentence.
Well,
I'll leave it to you to speak that in sentence four. That's what you got.
The word is of increase. That, you know, everything is plentiful and nothing is constrained. You know, the idea that you will lend to other people and you're not going to have to borrow from them is definitely an image of somebody who has more than they need.
Right.
And doesn't have to go to anyone else.
Independent. Very independent.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. What else do you see? There's more here. There's piety. Mm-hmm. Right? You will fulfill my commandments is reiterated multiple times in this section. Right? In the very beginning. And then it continues, Ki Sishma, when you listen to. And then it continues to say, when you guard the mitzvot in sentence 9. And then in sentence 10, they will see Hashem's name is called upon you. And then again, obviously, at the end of it, in sentence 13, sentence 14, when you listen to the commandments, piety is part of it. So that's another piece of it. Another piece of it is security. Right? Your enemies will be struck before you. Anybody who attacks you is not going to succeed. And the honor given to Torah. The idea that Hashem's name is called upon you and the nations see it and they recognize it and assign some kind of value to it. It inspires awe in them. Those are the four elements that you see here. There's prosperity, there's piety, there's security, and there is honor for the Torah that you represent. And the striking thing about this, and I knew, you know, we only have an hour to go through five prakams, so I knew I wasn't going to get into it in depth, but I gave you on the sheet in number 3, so this is something you can go through either, you know, either tonight or when you get up to Malachim and Yeshaya. But it's fascinating to see in Malachim, the moment when we reached our height, we were at our best, was when Shlomo HaMelech built the Beit HaMikdash. Right before his wives got into idolatry and he got into trouble, you have this moment, you know, you think of like you throw a ball up in the air and it reaches the apex and it's like, oh, this is great. And then it comes down. We're at that moment right before that. And everything there fits this description. We're told about great wealth. We're told about how other nations are sending tribute. There's no fear of enemies and Shlomo amasses weapons. Neshek is actually the word that's used there. We're told about great piety, the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Everyone is going to daven and they're going to bring karbanos and so on. And great respect for the Torah. That's the story where the Queen of Sheba comes and says, I've heard all these wonderful things about you. And she has all these questions. And she says, blessed is the God who gave you such wisdom. Those four elements are achieved there. The 11th parak in Yeshaya is the prediction of what Mashiach's time will look like. And again, same four elements you'll see there. That's the one with the lion lying down with the lamb and the wolf, the wolf with the lamb and that whole story. That's security and there's piety there, and there's prosperity there and honor for the Torah. It's all found there. And I showed you in number 4, because that one you won't get up to in 929, is the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, where he presents his vision of what will be in the time of Mashiach, and I underlined in the Hebrew to make it clear. He describes what the time of Mashiach will be like, and he says, "Ba'osu azman lo yisham lo ra'av v'lo milchama." There is no war at that point. Security. Lo kina v'tachris, there is no kina. I don't like translating the word kina because kina isn't really jealousy. Kina is outrage, indignation, which often is a product of jealousy, but isn't always that way. So I just leave kina as kina. There will be no competition. Shatova tia mushpas harbe. There will be bounty. There will be prosperity. All the delicacies will be as common as dust. And the only thing will be a pursuit of knowledge of Hashem. That's piety. And lefichach hi Yisrael chachamim gedolim. Therefore, we will be viewed as great sages. It's talking about in the eyes of the nations around us. That's the respect for and the honor of Torah. So that's what our goal is. I say all of this to you because when you go back now to Vayikra Chavav, right, where we are, Vayikra chapter 26, you find much of that there. Not entirely so. Not entirely as clear as it is in Parshas Kisavo in terms of the idea of the nations coming to you and recognizing the Torah within you, but I think you can see it there as well. I think that it is present. It's just more subtle than it will be in Parshas Kisavo. But I think it's worth contemplating what is it that Hashem wants us to achieve. Okay. One more note here. I'm not planning on going through the Tochacha, the warnings of punishment. Not because they're not fun, although they're not fun, but because there's so much else to talk about. If someone wants to ask something about it, you know, I'll be glad to discuss. But I wanted to show you something fascinating that happens afterwards. Actually, it'll require first that we look at what's in it. So we will see some of the Tochacha. Go back to chapter 26, sentence 6. I apologize. I need to go back to there first. The prediction of the future, this utopian time. Vishbati chayara amin haaretz. I will eliminate evil beasts from your midst. Harmful beasts will be eliminated. So, what is Hashem going to do with them? What does that mean? What does that mean?
They'll be like, keep the bear in the forest instead of in your cabin.
Two answers. Uh-huh. One answer is they'll stay in their environment, right? They're not going to come, they won't be in your midst anymore, okay? Here, it's from the land, sounds like it's not here at all. Correct. So tamed is an interesting idea, which again reminds us of Yeshaya and his prediction about the wolf lying down with the lamb and so on. It sounds like a prediction that they will be tamed. In fact, it's a machlokas. Take a look at source number 5 on your sheet, the Sifra. Medrash Halacha on the book of Vayikra has two different views. Vishbati chayara amin haaretz, I will eliminate the wicked beasts from the land. Rabbi Yehuda Omer ma'avira min ha'olam. Rabbi Yehuda said, Hashem is going to remove them from the world. The UN World Conservation Monitoring Agency is going to be upset.
The Syrian bear is no longer found in Israel, and I think not even in Syria. It's just the bears that they had in Israel and found them out aren't there.
So the Syrian bear is found elsewhere. The Syrian brown bear, isn't it? I'm remembering something, but I don't remember what I'm remembering now. But it is found elsewhere.
Is that okay?
If you like, but it is found somewhere. I came across something about it. It's months ago, but it does exist. So far. But Rabbi Yehuda says they're gone. Rabbi Shimon Omer Mashpiyas Anshelo Yizoku. Rabbi Shimon says they aren't going to cause harm. So these two visions, I think, are striking. Meaning, the eradication of evil on the one hand, and the conversion of evil to good, on the other hand. Rabbi Yehuda says, any news on the Syrian brown bear?
Yeah, so it is originally from Middle East, from Turkey to Turkmenistan. Today it is no longer in Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territory. It says it survives only in Turkey, Iran, and Iraq.
Okay. All right, I have no idea when I came across it.
That's where they are now.
All right. So Rabbi Yehuda... Yeah. Rabbi Yehuda says, in the time of Mashiach, evil is annihilated. Rabbi Shimon says, in the time of Mashiach, evil is reformed. Now, you could read this as a debate about the basic character of Hashem's creations, whether animal or human. Right? Rabbi Yehuda says, good is not eternal. Good is not guaranteed. It's possible that someone reaches a point where tshuva is no longer possible. Think Paro, right, in the parashios that we're reading these days. Hashem takes away his free will. He says, Paro, I'm sorry, you're done. Or he doesn't say you're sorry. That's Rabbi Yehuda. And Rabbi Shimon says, no. There's a remnant of good in everyone, and that is what can return. If you think of this classic story, the Gemara in Brachas with Bruria, right, where Rabbi Meir is being tormented by zealots in his area, and Rabbi Meir is davens to Hashem for them to die, and Bruria says to him, don't daven for them to die, daven for them to do tshuva. And even though the truth is Rabbi Meir's read of the pasuk Yitamuchata Ibn Haaretz, I think is grammatically more sound, nonetheless, the Gemara's conclusion is very much like Bruria, that it's better to daven that they do tshuva. That's what we do. Right? Hashibenu, Abinu Sarasacha, right? We daven for Hashem to bring us back to Torah. That's our goal. The Rambam has a halacha. The Gemara talks about a Talmud She'enu Hagun, about somebody who doesn't behave properly. Their character is bad. And the Gemara says you're not allowed to teach such a person Torah. Because all you're going to do by teaching them Torah is make them worse. Torah is compared to rain. So when rain falls on thorns, what do you get? More thorns. So don't do that. But the Rambam writes on that Gemara, when the Gemara says, so you're not allowed to teach them Torah, the Rambam says, no. What you do have to do is get them to proper behavior so that you'll be able to teach them Torah. You can't throw up your hands and say, let's keep them out of school, and then my response is, no. You have to keep them in school. You just have to teach them a different kind of education in order to get them to the point where they're then able to learn Torah. That's the optimism of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon is saying, you don't write off the beast, you have to defang the beast. And it's important because of what happens at the end of the Tochacha here. You get this very dry section. I'm just assuming that everybody did the five prakim this week. Don't tell me if you didn't, I don't want to know. But if you take a look after the punishments in Parakhav Zion, you get this very difficult section, dry section, the section called Erech, in which we are told that if a person pledges to give their Erech value to the Beis HaMikdash, then the amount that they give is X, depending on gender, depending on age, this is the amount they give. It is not based on a person's personal worth. It is not based on what they would fetch on the slave market. It is simply a number pegged to age and gender. The commentators note, it is not a statement of men are worth more than women. Notes the fact that the men depreciate more quickly as they age than the women do. The Gemara does talk about how when women age, they still do things of value around the house, whereas the men do not. That may be what you're thinking about?
That a male slave is valued as brute labor and that a female slave's tasks continue. I remember my husband learning this with my kids when they went through the Mishnah, so
right.
I overheard some of that.
Right, no, I mean, it's true. They make the point that having an old man around the house, it generally is just, somebody who complains, whereas having an old woman around the house, she can still contribute productively. So they do make that point. But the commentators of the Gemara generally say this is not taken as a person's personal value. But Abarbanel explains the transition here from warnings of punishment to if you decide to give your erach to the Beis HaMikdash, which is such a, it seems like a non sequitur. He says, after all the dire predictions of punishment, we might question ourselves, our own value. When you see all of these warnings and this is going to happen to you and this is going to happen to you, like at this point we got nothing left. Like you just like want to back away from the Torah, from the bris, from everything. And so the Torah says, no, everybody has a value. It's objective. It doesn't, you can't ruin it. You can't damage it. It's very much like Rabbi Shimon. Everyone has an erech of their own. So that's the segue from this the set of warnings to the erech that that concludes Sefer VaYikra. Clear? You can say you don't like it.
I don't know. I didn't think it was so strange, just because I know that in other cultures, people will give a value, like, for example, I don't know, one Muslim custom I heard about, that baby girl is 100 days old. Shave her head, weigh the hair, and the father translates that weight into gold, and he gives that much gold to charity. Like, the value of, whatever, 15 grams of gold is what he gives to charity. So to me, it's not weird that people would value, you know, would give a person, you know, and therefore they would have to redeem them for a certain right. amount of money, as opposed to just giving them. Also because we had a lot of mentioning of idolatry, and, you know, we all know that the Molech was a thing where people actually apparently sacrificed their children. So a
couple of notes. And in terms of Molech, it's actually a debate as to whether the children died in that ritual. It's not clear whether that was actually burning of, or whether it was passing between flames on some kind of a path before the idol.
Well, it's a symbolic human sacrifice.
Right.
They didn't actually kill them. I can break
it. Right, but in terms of the main point, the valuation, to me, isn't strange. The question was just, how is this coming from Tochacha? Why does one follow from the other? And I think that's what Abarbanel is addressing by saying, no, you still have an erech. Don't become depressed about the punishments and think that we have no worth. No. We still do have worth. Okay.